The RPG After Years is part of the We Can Make This Work Probably Network. Find out more at probablywork.com.
Hey folks, my name's Brett and I'm one of the hosts of Skeleton House, an audio-only Let's Play podcast where my two friends Jess...
What is happening? Oh my god!
...and Steve...
Even he looks spooked.
...play through video games and I edit them, add context, and act as your eyeballs. Also, we have a cat. Come check us out at skeletonhouse.buzzsprout.com or look up Skeleton House on your favorite podcast app. Or your least favorite podcast app. I'm not here to tell you how to live your life.
RPG After Years, your weekly show covering all things RPGs in the past, present, and future. This is episode 82. I'm Scott.
And I'm Rich.
And once again, we are joined by special guest.
It's me, Frost again.
Yep, so those that didn't listen to the last episode, Frost is here because he's the one that nominated the game that we're going to be completing the review for today. It's once again the 1993 SNES classic RPG, Secret of Mana. Since this is a review, we won't be doing all our normal segments today. It'll just be, you know, some show updates and straight up review goodness. We'll talk about the RPG Club for a minute, so I'll launch into that. Hey guys, it's Scott coming to you from the future, from when this episode was recorded. So I just wanted to make the announcement about the RPG Club real quick. As we announced last week, the new RPG Club game is Mass Effect, the first one. And that should be in full swing by the time you're listening to this. The first checkpoint is to clear the tutorial mission, clear the Citadel, and leave the Citadel. Once you've left the Citadel, you can don't go to the next planet. You can do other side missions, just don't go to, I believe it's Theorem, which is also called the Dig Site. So yeah, just don't go to Theorem or the Dig Site, and that should be the whole section. So yeah. I'm excited to play this game with everybody. As for the RPG releases for this week, on September 30th, we got Astria Ascending coming to PS5, PS4, Xbox Series, Xbox One, Switch, and PC. So like everything, basically. Rogue Lords coming to PC on the 30th as well. Actually, all these games that I'm about to name are coming on the 30th. Darksiders 3 coming to the Switch. Shenmue Sword 7 coming to PS4 and Xbox One. Unsighted coming to PS4, Xbox One, Switch, and PC. Death's Gambit Afterlife coming to Switch and PC. Mary Skelter Finale coming to PS4 and Switch. And finally, Vagrish the Riven Realms coming to PC only on October 5th. As for the RPGs coming up this week, we got Book of Travels coming to PC on October 11th. That's entering early access. Disco Elysium, the final cut, coming to Xbox Series, Xbox One, and Switch on October 12th. Hey, that's my birthday. And I'm actually interested in playing that game. Maybe it's a sign. Monster Crown, coming to PS4, Xbox One, Switch, and PC, also on the 12th. That's exiting early access, actually. And then Dungeon Encounters, coming to PS4, Switch, and PC on October 14th. And that's it. Okay, back to the present timeline. With all that out of the way, we're going to go ahead and talk about the gameplay this week. All right, who wants to talk about the gameplay first?
I can get started on that.
Okay.
It's awesome. There's gameplay. There is. So the gameplay itself is pretty basic in itself. In a sense, we'll talk about mechanics on character movement, obviously normal D-pads, things like that. The biggest thing on gameplay would be the charge attack abilities. So me personally did not read the manual to understand this part. Scott had to tell me about this at the very end, probably last section of it. So the charge attack ability is when you hit the button to charge it after you've did the first hit, the character will then hold back and hold on to that ability. Depending on what level that weapon is, either if one to eight, and then it would just release a series of attacks, which is a nice little feature if you would have used it from the very beginning.
Right. Yeah. And that comes from the fact that the game's sort of like pseudo turn-based, right? In that there's actually a quote from the developer who said they wanted to make an action game, but they didn't want to make it a straight action game because they were worried that bad players couldn't finish it. So they added RPG-like elements to the game, so, as Rich points to himself.
Yep,
you could level up and get stronger, because they said, the nice thing about RPGs is, basically, paraphrasing, you could always level your way out of it. So they wanted to do that. So, but it is pseudo turn-based in that there is a timer. It's somewhere like an ATB bar, right? In that you have to wait till the charge till you get to 100%, then you can strike with your weapon. If you don't do that, you could still move your weapon and attack, but it does like almost no damage. And then, as Rich was saying, you can actually extend that charge beyond 100% to do additional damage. And that was one of the key things to using, you know, doing high damage attacks. Is holding down the button and doing 200%, 300%, 400%, all the way up to, you know, 900% damage with your regular attacks.
Depending on your weapon level. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you do, it is a free roaming thing. You have total control of your characters during the battles. It's not like there's a separate battle screen. Your partner characters will attack for you depending on how you set their AI. Before we lead the subject of the charge attacks, I found myself not using them that often. Just because...
Me either.
I guess maybe this is probably my main complaint about the game. Because I don't know if it's because it is pseudo turn-based, but like you have to sort of learn the enemy's animations.
That's right. And so being sort of like a, you know, basically an expert in the combat, right? Because I played it so many times. If you have the enemy AI memorized, then you know when to charge your attacks, because you know you can sneak in a one level charge here to do extra damage. You know when you need to wait. But there are times where the enemy is invulnerable. And if you don't know their animations, then you're going to use your attack on an invulnerable enemy. You waste that attack. And then you also have the issue of timing, because you have three party members all swinging weapons. And you could have a situation where the sprite with like a weak weapon hits the enemy, which causes it to take a little amount of damage, but then become invulnerable. While you're saving up like a big charge attack, all of a sudden you release it on an invulnerable enemy and you just wasted, a ton of time on that. And I feel like the only way to get around that is to play the game a lot and just know every enemy's animation for every way you hit it, which fortunately I know, but it's, I put in my 10,000 hours or so, right?
Yeah. Well, it's just very frustrating, just because it feels like a lot of times that even though there kind of is, that there isn't a rhyme or reason as to why sometimes your attacks connect and sometimes they don't.
There are iffy hitboxes on some enemies too, and I actually read that they doubled the hitboxes for boss fights just because the sprites were so big. They wanted to make sure that they would collide, but they only did it for melee weapons. So you'd have an advantage using melee weapons. Which is why the whip, I believe, is probably the best boss killing weapon, because it's a long range melee weapon.
The whip in general was one of my favorite weapons. So that's another thing we haven't talked about. So you do have 8 different weapons you can use in this game. Let's see, the sword, bow, boomerang, javelin, spear.
Fist.
What else?
Yep. Fist, axe, whip.
Right. Okay.
And is that eight?
Yeah, I think so. So they all do play pretty differently. I think that's one thing I do enjoy about the gameplay is that the weapon system, some are better than others, but in general, the weapon system, it does vary up the gameplay quite a bit. And I didn't really feel like there was any one weapon that was definitely the worse than the others. There were a couple that were better for, I thought, but did you?
Yeah. And it comes down to, you know, as you get to know the weapons, you learn their attack animations, and there's just probably ones you just feel more comfortable with. Like the bow has a distinct drawback, so there's a little bit of a delay to it. Whereas the sword's pretty quick as far as when you get your attack off. So, and there are technically levels of height in the game as far as when you're attacking enemies. So yeah. Things like the javelin, maybe we missed the javelin. That's why I only counted seven, but the javelin and the bow can attack multiple heights, whereas everything else is sort of on a plane. So there are some situations where you'd want to use one weapon over another in combat, but mostly they're interchangeable.
Do you guys find yourself leaning on certain weapons more than others, or did you try to keep them kind of evenly leveled?
I mean, I kept them all evenly. Well, not necessarily as best I could. I did sword for the guy. I think spear for the sprite, and then the whip for the girl. That's mainly what I used.
What about you, Frost?
So yeah, the way I usually play is to try to level everything as much as possible. But I do make sure that the boy's sword level is always up to date. But I actually don't like using the sword. I usually end up using the spear or the axe most of the time, just because I like the animation.
Gotcha. See, I tried to keep all the levels or weapons leveled more or less evenly on all the characters throughout the game. And by the end of the game, most of them were they weren't maxed out, but they were getting there on most of the characters. Of course, I did a lot of grinding. But I do think it might have shot myself in the foot a little bit. Like, how much easier would the game have been if I had, you know, maybe focused on one or two weapons per character?
Yeah, and it turns out, and there's a lot of hidden formulas in this game as far as damage goes, but when you fight the final boss, your damage level with mana magic on, so when you have the actual sword of mana, is dependent not only on the sword's level, but actually on all of the boy's weapon levels.
That's a
good
point. So
the more weapon levels you have in all your weapons, the more overall damage you will do. So it is always a good idea to keep, at least for the boy, to keep his levels up for all the weapons.
I mean, you watched me play the final boss live. If I wasn't doing 999 damage with every hit on that battle, I probably wouldn't have made it. So, I would say overall the weapon system is cool. Is that something that carries on over into other Mana games where you have a bunch of different
ones? Yeah, so Final Fantasy Adventure had a similar system where, and I know this is crossing out of combat into sort of non-combat, but there are multiple weapons and they also have field uses, like chopping down, like in Final Fantasy Adventure, the axe chops down trees. Here it chops down like sort of middling block type things. The whip is used to traverse gaps and things like that. So there are reasons to have the other weapons in that. I did in Trials, though, it's it feels like they abandoned that, and it's just each character has a weapon they focus in: sword, staff.
Interesting.
Correct. Yeah. Like that.
Okay. I guess that's one thing you said, non-combat. So there are certain things that you need the weapons out of combat for, like crossing gaps with the whip, or breaking down rocks with the axe.
Yep.
I thought that was a cool idea, but in practice it ended up kind of annoying me more than anything, just because it was annoying to have to switch weapons and then switch back and then switch again. I mean,
yeah, but by the end of the game, when you're trying to get through a level, you almost have to have one character with each of the traversal items so that you can just swap characters instead of having to go into the menus. And you're like, okay, it's time to go over a gap, get the girl. Oh, it's time to chop down a thing, get the sprite, you know.
It almost had me missing like Zelda almost, where you just have things that are assigned to different buttons. But yeah, so I feel like that was a good idea, maybe implemented kind of poorly. Did you have any thoughts on that, Rich?
No, it's just gameplay. It's simplistic to it. I mean, once you figure it out, like Frost said, once you master the combat. Once you master a few little things to it, you can easily breeze through it. Kind of transition into the menu system next.
Sure.
The menu system was garbage.
Excellent.
So, okay.
Did you read the interview from the developer who said it was innovative and it was there was a reason to the madness?
He was obviously drunk.
So, I also read that interview. I was like, okay, well, he's proud of it, but
well, the reason they use this ring, it's called the ring menu system. And the reason they did it is because instead of like a classical RPG where you hit the menu button and you go to a menu screen, which every other game has pretty much, the menu pops up over the character and you have three menus. You have one for the boy, one for the girl, and one for the sprite. And the ring will appear over the character's head of whose menu it is. And you have three, you have and basically the reason they did that is because you don't have a separate menu screen. So everything stays on screen. You don't have to go to a different screen to go into menus. And they chose, when they did this, they chose the ring. So it's basically a complete circle of items. And you sort of tick, tick, like Wheel of Fortune style. You have to spin the ring to get to different things. And I'm sure looking at Rich's face right now, he is very enthusiastic about this system.
Nope. Because what happens if the characters are a bunch together? You don't know who the hell you're on.
Most of us learned to like spread out your characters in a straight line to where you could tell which character you were looking at.
Listen, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Well, if you memorize button combinations like I have, it's second nature for me to go into whoever's menu. But I realize that on a first playthrough, this might be not the best. I understand.
When you get to that point, like by halfway through the game, you know it. It's understandable. Like you can traverse it pretty good and everything like that. And the new player, like you said, obviously would have a little bit of issue going into that. Yeah. But I like the menu system. I like being able to push a button and go in and so, okay, I need to move these things. This is how it is. So Scott, what about your opinion about the ring system?
Well, I mostly agree with you, but by the end of the game, I'd gotten used to it and thought I could see how some people might find this to be neat or whatever. Another issue that I had, and I don't know if this is something that was like a Switch issue, but like it was super easy with the sensitivity to just scroll right past the actual thing you were trying to select over and over again.
What were you playing with, Joy-Cons?
The Pro Controller, usually. Oh, I also played with Joy-Con, and it was an issue on both.
I feel like it was because it was designed for a D-pad, and if you were using an analog stick, that might be part of that.
Yeah, I know Bill was talking about how he had the same issue. So do you think it was an issue at all on the SNES? Do you remember?
I don't remember it being one. I know that there's definitely an overshoot. Like if you're going to a certain thing on a ring, like even in the past with the SNES controller, I'd probably overshoot a couple of times and have to go back. But I did on the same thing on the Switch when I was using it, especially with the Joy-Cons. It was like, I'd hit left, but it would be cycling down menus. And I'm like, oh, this is awful. Like who would ever play a game with a menu system like this? But I know that when I got out my Pro Controller with the D-pad, it was more like the old way. So it could also be that this was designed for another era also.
It could also be that even on the Pro Controller, I was still using the control stick. So, I did have the thought that maybe it had to do with the fact that they designed it to be multiplayer. And so they wanted you to like not have to go to a separate screen and all that, but you still have the separate menus, like the level menus and the magic menus that do take up the whole screen. So I'm not sure if that was a reason or related. Speaking of, while we bring it up, the game is multiplayer, and you could have all three people playing if you had the right accessory. Even back in the day, Rich and I didn't do that at all. I thought about having Corey join in with me at least once just to try it out. He wasn't interested. But Frost, how do you feel about it? Does it work well?
So I did it growing up. I did it with my brother. It was generally enjoyable, although he's not really big into RPGs. So, and I tried it on the Switch with my son, who's 8, but he was like, what is this? What is this game? Can we play Marvel's Avengers where we just blow stuff up now? I think it works really well. It's certainly, as far as having a multiplayer RPG, I can't think of one off the top of my head that did it like this, where you're all playing at the same time especially in 1993.
I know some of the classic Final Fantasies allowed you to go into like the configuration menu and assign different characters to different slots.
Yeah, like six, you could play multiplayer where you get like two people get two of the battle characters and two people get another of the battle character, or another person gets another battle character. But to be able to run around in real time, it was really neat.
Yeah.
You know, that would be an issue when one person wanted to go left and one person wanted to go right, and then you're just stuck there. So
do you feel like it made the game easier?
It definitely does. I think the speed runs recommend that you have three people so that you no one ever gets stuck while you're running around.
Yeah. So that goes into the AI, which I guess considering what all they're trying to do isn't that bad, but the AI a lot of times does seem like it's really making things harder than it needs to be.
Yeah. I mean, if you don't go in and assign the AI for a character and you don't know how to do that, it makes a very troublesome thing during combat.
I believe the default setting is for them to do nothing.
Yeah.
Which I think someone mentioned it in the club the first session. They're like, so this game was really hard until I figured out I had to basically turn on my AI compatriots. Then they started attacking. It made it a lot easier.
Yeah, I bet. I remember that too. And there's like 16 different AI settings, and it's like a mixture of how much you want them to run or defend or attack or keep away, that type of thing. Do you guys remember like which would you change up your AI based on the situation, or did you just stick with the same one pretty much the whole time?
Same one, all out attack, beat the crap out of everything.
I like my magic users to stay alive, so I'd keep them far away and give them ranged weapons.
That makes sense.
In the business,
there was a couple times where I was on death's door and just had to like run out of a dungeon where I had to go in and change the characters, be like, do not attack, because they will stop and attack every enemy. Mm. And it's kind of like, even if you're running way ahead, they don't want to catch up with you.
You mean you didn't use your magic rope, Scott, that was somehow cursed for you?
Yeah.
How did you not be able to use that?
There was only a couple times I needed it where it didn't work. So this is an item that it's supposed to be like an escape or a warp spell where it just takes you out of the dungeon. I feel like literally every time I needed it, it just happened to not work. The Witch's Castle doesn't count as a dungeon for some reason at all.
And neither does Santa's Castle.
Yeah. And I think that the other major time that I ran into trouble was the demon wall in the Pandoran ruins or whatever. So I got to the room where you speak with Thanatos and saved there, or made my save state or whatever. And that once you're in that room, you can't use the rope. And I feel like that there's at least one or two other times where I was like, this thing is useless.
But you just had rope.
Yeah. But alas, yeah, that sucks. Let's see, what else? We haven't talked about magic yet, which this game does have a kind of an interesting magic system.
Yeah. So the magic system, you want to talk about the magic spells themselves or the leveling system first?
We can do the leveling first.
Okay, so like the weapons, which gain weapon levels by defeating enemies, the magic spells gain levels based on how many times you cast them, similar to like if you've played Final Fantasy II or even like a Oblivion type game, where the more you use something, the more it levels.
Grandia 1 comes to mind as well.
Yeah. And, excuse me. And so this is good in that the more you use something, the better it is, but it's also bad in that the scaling on this is probably my biggest gripe with the entire game, which is that getting level 8 magic is such a huge time investment. And so you have to cast spells over and over and over again. And each of your magic casters has 7 spell types they have to level. So you're talking about 8 levels for 7 different magics is a lot of casts.
I spent a lot of time in those frozen woods just casting magic over and over and over.
Same here.
I personally hate when RPGs do this. Like, give me some other way to level it, please. I don't care if it's just experience points or whatever, but don't make me use the thing over and over, because then it's just useless and you don't want to use it, but you need to use it.
Yeah, well, I'll look forward to how you felt about FF2 when you review that with Bill.
You mean bonus dungeon, the game?
Bonus dungeon. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
But yeah, typically people ask me, you know, how much leveling of magic should you do? And I usually say, well, make sure you get Lumina up, as Scott found out.
Yeah.
Because Lumina, unfortunately, there's not a lot of enemies that are that need Lumina, which is why it's hardly ever used and why it was underleveled for you. Except the last two bosses need Lumina.
I'm so glad you told him that before I got there. So I was like, I'm going to go level up Lumina. And I did. And I went through that dungeon. I just rocked through everything. And Scott's like, I'm having trouble.
By the time I got the last couple of spells, I was just ready to get to the end. And so I was like, I don't need to grind anymore. I'm not having any trouble.
I got this.
But then it turns out that there's a couple bosses that you just really need it for.
Oh, Scott's final fights were just unbelievable. He was running out of magic, and I'm like, oh, by the way, Scott, if you have no MP, you can't beat the final boss because you have to cast mana magic. So if you run out of fairy walnuts, you might as well just reset the game.
And I did. Well, I didn't reset it, but I did.
You didn't have to. But yeah, you were down to like the very bare bones, what you had left.
Barely eke by. So like Frost said, there are like eight different elements, and both the boy can't use magic, but the girl and the sprite can, and all their spells are different, and there's like one element each that's exclusive to one of them. So there's lots of different spells in this game. I guess one thing that's annoying is when the enemies cast spells on you, because it, like, while the spell animation's going off, you're completely immobile.
Right, that's the biggest thing about magic, is that it pauses. Basically, whoever is the recipient of the spell is frozen. Other people can move around. So if you cast Cure on yourself, you're frozen. If you cast Ice Ball or whatever it is, Ice on an enemy, it's frozen. And that's a good thing, because you can actually time out your attacks where you can freeze a boss in place and not let them ever move.
Yep.
If you know how to use the menu system.
And I did that a lot. Once I figured it out, I was like, okay, he's not going to move ever. And I blasted the crap out of him, especially with Lumina.
Yeah. And I remember the first boss of the game, the Mantis, not knowing all the combat mechanics yet, it has some moves where it is magic and just completely locks you in place. I remember being like, what am I doing wrong? It feels totally unfair. I can't do anything.
That brings it back to it's like that pseudo turn-based nature where it's like, it's almost like you're locked in a turn-based combat at that point.
Yeah, which I didn't totally understand yet. So you have to spend a lot of time leveling magic. It kind of forces you to use a lot of the different elements, but did you guys find yourselves using certain elements more than others, or
fire a lot? I use that a lot.
Some of the magics are just straight damage, but there are a lot of status effect magics and things that boost or buff your party or debuff the opponents. I don't know how much you guys use those.
Not very much.
I didn't use the debuff ones a lot, but especially towards the end with the moon magic, that was kind of OP if it was leveled, as far as the support stuff. If an enemy was weak, I would cast the elemental sword spells or whatever to that. Oh, but that reminds me, there's also treasure chests in the overworld I feel like until you get the analyze spell, like 80-90% of them are mimic trap spells.
They're all traps.
It's like you open it and then like there's a bomb inside every time.
Yeah, that happened to me a lot. I eventually just stopped opening chests. This is ridiculous.
I think there's like a 1 in 64 chance you get the death one too. And I think you got one in your final run through of the Mana Fortress, Scott, when I was watching you. You were like, I analyzed it. Why did I die? And I'm like, well.
I must not have actually analyzed it or something.
Yeah, you didn't wait long enough for the spell to go through.
Yeah. Of course, if you keep stocked up on items, where if you're grinding, you have plenty of money to buy as much items as you need. You really don't need the stuff from the chest until the final couple of dungeons, where they start dropping like very minor, very rare armor upgrades. But other than that, I kind of wish I hadn't wasted so much time analyzing chests in the end.
Yeah. Well, the thing about it, because if you noticed, one of your big complaints, I think, Scott, at the early game was when you go shopping, you'd be like, how do I know if this is better? And I just tell you, if it costs more, it's better. That's all you need to know.
Yeah.
But there's the weapons, the armor and the weapons all have special stats that are not in the game menu. You have to go to the manual to find out that, like, the level 3 spear will balloon an enemy, or the the amulet armor that you get like from one of the drops in the mana fortress protects you against petrify or things like that's not include. There's not, the menus are very bare bones. So you don't really get that information in game. You have to go to an outside source or the manual, I guess.
I'd almost forgotten about that. So I'm glad you mentioned it. Yeah. The shops, they don't tell you anything about what you're buying until you buy them. And then you have to get into the menus, and even the menus don't tell you what the items do. So luckily there's not that many items and eventually you'll learn. But at the time I was like, how am I supposed to know? And I ended up just, you know, looking up a shit ton of things. It was kind of a long running joke in the Discord. Like, we would ask the same questions over and over and over about the simplest things. And Frost would just be like, read the manual. Came like the catchphrase of the RPG club this time. Of course, Rich can't read, so that's difficult.
You know what? Put it in the game. I don't have to go out to the outside resource to figure it out.
Just they didn't have space for a story. How are they going to fit it in the game?
That's true.
They ran out of time to translate the item.
That might be more of
that's
it.
What it was.
I wonder.
But yeah, so I guess that about covers the magic. What else? Is there anything else to the combat that we haven't talked about yet, really?
There are status effects like being moogled or shrunken, right. Minied.
I feel like those were rarely a big problem for me.
Yeah. You get an item that cures Moogle and an item that cures Mini too. The Moogle item, the Moogle belt you get if you just go back, return to the dwarf village and you talk to the chief. And then the one side quest in the game, you could gain the midge mallet, as it's called,
right,
from the dwarf, and you get the Moogle belt if you get the sea hare's tail and restore water to Kakara village,
right?
The one side quest.
What about outside of combat? So there are villages you can go to and talk to everybody, learn some you should go do this type deal, and then there's shops and inns. It's pretty standard though as far as, you know, classic RPG village. And okay, well, did you guys find yourselves trying to play as certain characters, or did it matter to you? It's really easy to switch between them at any time.
Because of the nature of the casting, it's easier to play as the boy and use the sub menus to cast magic with the other characters because the character who's casting is
that
frozen.
Makes sense. Yeah.
So you can still move around and attack or charge your attack with the boy while one of your compatriots is casting. So that's typically what I did.
Gotcha. Good thing you don't have to level the characters individually and they all level up at once. Although, isn't there a mechanic where you get slightly more experience for whoever lands the killing blow?
So you get more weapon experience. So your weapon, whoever does if you strike the final blow on an enemy, you get double the weapon experience, I believe.
Gotcha.
So that's why you typically, when people play the game, the boy has the most weapon levels, which is good because it's related. But if you played where you were killing stuff with the girl, she would have the most weapon levels.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, I think we've covered all the individual gameplay elements, unless you guys can think of any we missed.
Not that I know of.
Cannon travel and Flammy.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up. There's a world map. It's in mode 7, just like all the other Final Fantasy and other RPGs of that era, where everything's just kind of laid out flat and the map rotates with you. And it's pretty cool, I guess, for this era. At first, I found controlling Flammy a little difficult, just because it has this weird effect where when you raise and or ascend and descend, it goes from like a parallel view to like an overhead view, and you just kind of land in the area you want. So you had to kind of learn the world map and where things were if you wanted to have any hope of traversing and figuring out where you wanted to go. Even if you have a world map in front of you, like on your computer screen or whatever, it was a little difficult for me.
Yeah, did you ever there's a button to turn it into like a globe view. Did you ever do that?
I did, but it was so slow to load. It like very slowly paints onto the screen.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is weird.
I don't know if that was because of a graphical limitation or what. Yeah. And then even then you can't use that to like show you where things are, right? Yeah, I didn't think so.
No, you need to have your map from the manual.
Exactly. There you go. Is there a world map in the manual?
Well, the game came with a manual and a world map.
Oh, of course.
With the locations on it.
Gotcha.
Of course it did. Yeah, great. Awesome for people who don't have that. Awesome.
Yeah, but it did fly very smoothly. Over, I got used to it, and I thought that was pretty good to okay. I did like that they give you the drone that lets you just leave wherever you are instantly.
Yeah. I think they built like a little bit of an acceleration into Flammy too. It's like where if you'd have to kind of pick up speed. I guess that was intentional.
Yeah, and overall, I'd say the world is fairly small, so it's easy to like just fly around and pass things you need easily. And then of course there's the Kanan travel, like you mentioned, where it's basically just a fast travel system that gets used a lot before you get Flammy. You pay a Do you pay for it? Yeah, you paid, right?
Yeah, I think there's one trip that ends up being free, but most of them are 50 GP.
Gotcha. So I guess it's the most interesting form of fast travel I've seen in maybe ever. You literally get in a cannon and it just blasts you wherever you need to go. I did end up wishing that instead of certain cannons going to certain places, that it was just like you could go to any of them that you had been to or something like that from other ones. But yeah. What else?
That's really about it on the gameplay for it.
All right.
Well, weapons, magic, and everything else.
I've scrolled down to the bosses here. Are there any bosses we want in particular that we want to talk about? I know for me, the damn spiky tiger, and then only a couple bosses later, the wall face, were almost game quitters for me.
Yeah, bosses, I didn't have any problems.
Bosses before magic are typically very difficult. So that's why the spiky tiger is known as one of the harder bosses, because you're very low level. You have no magic. You're limited healing items. You have a couple candies.
The tiger's like jumping around to places where you can't reach them without long range weapons.
And it does status effects. Like it puts people unconscious. So
I actually had to leave the castle and go grind elsewhere for a while, which was its own harrowing experience, because as we have discussed, the magic rope doesn't work there. And I was so low on life, I had to just kind of like run out of there and just run past everything. And hopefully I survived. And I did eventually, although it took a few tries. And then you get the wall face, which is kind of like, you can think of it like the demon wall of this game. And it's got you have to like take out the eyeballs to make it lose its more damaging attacks. But then they get revived. And then the first time you fight it, it will like you. Once it's take both eyes are dead, it makes you forces you into the spikes at the back of the room. Classic demon wall shit, and it just felt impossible. So, also when I got there, I had that dungeon where you fight the wall face has enemies that are basically only vulnerable to magic. So I was more or less out of MP by the time I got there, and so there was just like no hope. I had to go back out and restore and just run past enemies to get to the face, and then I was able to succeed. But yeah, those early bosses, like I said, you guys know how dedicated I am to this show, but I was literally gonna be like, okay, Rich, you're just gonna be tell me about what happened this past couple weeks. But yeah, other bosses you guys want to talk about?
I will say the demon wall has the worst hitboxes in the game.
It's terrible because
the center eye hitbox is only available in like the two frames that the eye is open, so it's very, if you're not using magic, it's very difficult to take down.
Yeah, once you learn, you just got to spam magic. It's easy, but
that's all I did. I spam magic every chance I got with everything, so I didn't really have that much trouble.
Yeah,
so I cheated.
The vampires are tough because, again, they have their hitboxes are weird, where the vampire will descend and land and then fly into the air, and you can only hit it with weapons while it's descended. So, again, if you aren't using magic, which it's weak to Lumina. I did tell Bill, though, because Bill finished it last, I told him that according to the game mechanics, the freeze spell is the highest damaging 2 MP spell. So if you only level 1 magic spell, you should level freeze.
Oh, I'm not sure I knew that. I thought they were just all equal, just different elements.
Yeah, most of them are, but the freeze spell ends up being for some reason has a slightly higher multiplier.
Okay. Yeah, the vampire bosses suck.
The some of the normal enemies are pretty bad, like the shadow stalkers, those ninja things will just like pop up out of the ground and just like one shot you occasionally.
Yeah. I thought the shadow selves were the shadow characters or whatever that you fight at the Test of Courage. That was a really interesting boss. Not really difficult or anything, but most, I think, scrolling up and down, that's really the only ones that leave a notable impression. The second slime boss was interesting because, as Rich mentioned, you know, it grows and basically eventually prevents you from moving, so hopefully you have magic. And then we kind of already talked about the final bosses already. So I think that might be it for the gameplay. So this game is way more about its gameplay than its story. So how did you guys end up feeling about it overall? You can go first, Ross.
Oh, that was Rich with his sigh of exasperation. Go ahead, Rich. I know you want to talk about it. Go ahead.
It's fine. I mean, realistically, when this came out, it was innovative. Okay, so we got to put that in context that, you know, back in the day when this came out, it was groundbreaking. It was amazing. Now that we've had a lot different video games under our belts, a lot of different RPG mechanics, gameplay, the whole Final Fantasy series evolution, same with Dragon Quest, Tales, all those games have changed since then. So we've got to really put that in perspective. At the time, it would have been amazing. Now, I'm not too fond of it.
Yeah. I kind of mirror that sentiment in that, I mean, I played it at the time and I was like, wow, this is, you know, this is amazing. I was like, it's almost like real time kind of.
Yeah.
You know, having put so much time in and playing this game so many times, I love the combat, but again, you know, I have all the animations memorized, so I don't ever have a problem with it. Like I think from the final playthrough of all the Pure Lands and the Mana Fortress, I only had to cast Cure Water like one time. Like I didn't even get hit like most of the thing, because you have so many spells and tricks you can use. And again, it's, you know, just knowing, you know, if you're gonna dedicate so much time to it, I guess you better be able to do that. So
yeah. Once I had you know, magic and had leveled some, I really didn't have any problems with the game other than maybe that final boss. But I'll agree that it's one of those that it's hard to judge, because I don't think when it came out there was anything else like it really that I know of. And it is unfortunately one of those games that is hard to go back to, I think, for a lot of people, myself included. Overall, I did enjoy it. I'm glad I played it. I think it's up there with some of the better RPG Club games we've played. Definitely liked it more than WoW overall. So, yeah. So, any other thoughts about the gameplay before we move on?
No. There's a couple of switch puzzles and things like that that we didn't talk about. Especially in the last the underground city. There's a couple of switch puzzles where you have to step on a switch and it opens a door somewhere else, and you got to track down where that door was. There's one thing where you have to do red light, green, or this three colored light or four colored lights you got to put in the right order.
Oh, I forgot about that.
But that's really all there is for puzzles. There are actually more puzzles in Final Fantasy Adventure than there were in Secret of Mana.
Maybe they did that because of the, I don't know, the multiplayer thing. That's weird. Mm. All right. So before we move on to our ratings, we do have a tea time from Bill.
And now it's time we join an old friend once again. It's tea time with Bill.
Hello everybody, and welcome to everybody's favorite segment of the show. That's right, it's the secret tea time with Bill. The secret of tea time. The secret of tea is don't throw it in the water in Boston. You ruin it. Sorry. Still hurts, man. All that tea just wasted. How could you? How could you waste the tea? Anyway, Secret of Mana. Oh, guys and girls. And Frost. Frost, mate, you nominated this game, so props to you. I've always wanted to play Secret of Mana. And if I'm honest, if it wasn't for the podcast / RPG Club, I don't think I would have made it that far into the game before probably giving up. You know, I'm going to be completely honest there. That is the truth. I would have got up to around about probably 4 Spikey, actually, and just been like, oh,
This is a mess. I can't hit anything. Nothing works. This menu system is atrocious. Oh my god, who shat out this menu system and decided to put it into a game? I will never, ever know. Anyway, but I loved it. By the time I got to the end of this game, I just about grasped the terrible, terrible menus. I'd still get stuck occasionally and just be like, who is this? Whose menu am I on? Who am I? Eventually, you know, you get the hang of the menus. You get the hang of the wonky hitboxes, which just, I don't know. I mean, good points after playing Adventure, Final Fantasy Adventure, so the first Mana game, is that that's also got wonky hitboxes. So a question to you, Frost, does Trials of Mana also have wonky hitboxes? Because I think this is like a series staple, you know. Have you hit it? Have you? Who knows? We don't. Nobody knows. But, you know, there were some good points of this game, such as the music. Oh my god, the music is so, so bloody good. The thick of it, the forest theme, Meridian Dance right at the end, Dark Star. You know, one of the bad points is the beginning bit of the boss music. That. Oh god, that is like ear splitting and horrific. But once you get past that bit, the rest of the boss music is amazing. It's so, so good. Just, yeah, absolutely loved the music from this game. And I would give music a 10 out of 10. I'll give my scores later. But yeah, that fucking Dwarf Town music is awful. So it's probably going to get a 4 out of 10 for me. You know, you have to balance things out. Everything else in the music soundtrack is great, but then you've got the dwarf thing. Not happening for me. I've already spoken about the hitboxes. I've already spoken about the menu system, which, they tried to be innovative. And I imagine back in the day, it would have probably been okay. But, dude, this is the SNES. There is an L and an R button. And even there is a menu to switch between your stats for your weapons and your magics, which let you use L and R. Why not, when you've got the menu open, just have the L and R buttons to switch between the two, rather than having like the Y button to switch to your alternative characters and then the X button, whatever it is, to be your main character, and then you have to push Y to go between them. It was just nonsense. Like, just L and R, just, you know, go between them, see the menu go around. So much simpler. I don't know why they didn't think of that. It's just like, the only time the L and R buttons are used is for this one thing in the menu. It's like, come on, man. But the weapons was great fun. Now, my favourite weapons is going to be the whip, the sword, the boomerang, and the bow, and probably the spear. Loved the spear. Those were my top tier weapons for me. Always alternating between them. Absolutely great. I did also, I think if I was ever to play this again, I'd definitely do a run where I'd max out the metal knuckles, because you basically do kung fu fighting. Like, I used it for a little while and it was really, really cool. But I preferred having a bit of range on my enemies, if I'm honest with you. If you got wonky hitboxes, you don't want wonky hitboxes and being up in their face. So, you know. leveling magic was great fun. Obviously, Frost, you told me about the lovely tip of the sprite's granddad, which I assume you've all spoken about. So I'm not going to go into depth, but yep, spamming her music on, spamming the girl's magic to level it up, and then using the granddad to instantly replenish your MP was a great little thing. I only used it to get cure up to like level 5 or something at the time. And I think I went back to do one other thing later on in the game, but I got bored really quickly. I couldn't be bothered with it. But there's also a really good spot where you can do the same for the sprite's magic. So there's the little squirrel thing that's on the boat that takes you to the moon palace and back. He is an enemy. He shows up as an enemy and you can attack him with the sprite's magic. And if you kill him, you can walk off screen and come back and he'll be back. But, you know, if you're just using the sprite's magic and you're trying to level up your MP, you can just spam the MP spell on him. You can spam the MP spell on other things, but yeah, any of her attacks which are like status types of attacks, you can use it on that rabbit thing without killing it, and you can just level it up, you know, get a few fairy walnuts, come in, come out. Yeah, that was really good. You know, again, I got bored really quickly. I didn't do too much of it. I probably spent about 5-10 minutes doing it, and that was it. But yeah, there's a good little tip for you guys there. And the only thing I wish I could have explored with this game would have been co-op mode. I've seen quite a few people talk about playing it back in the day, having a mate come round and taking control of one of the other characters. Because let's face it, your other characters are 80% useless assisting you in battle. So yeah, having an actual human controlling one of the other characters, I imagine that would have actually been great fun. As for the story, you know, I mean, what was up with the mana beasts? Like, they're all just flying around the forest, but then didn't really feel that came off. I feel bad for this game. This game had so much potential. And obviously, there's the whole history with the disc system and having to try and squeeze it all onto a cartridge. And obviously, the story was always going to suffer. Thankfully, the gameplay and everything else did not. This game works perfectly. It's a beautiful game. It looks amazing. And it's just, it really has that magical feel to it. You know, this world is magical. You feel the magic as you're playing the game. It all comes through from the sprite work, from the animations, from the music. Kenji Ito did a fantastic job, and that's what he's always set out to do with the manga games, and he really succeeded with this. But yeah, unfortunately, the story with all the restrictions and everything else just kind of fell a bit flat for me. Didn't really understand who the mana beasts are. Who is Diluc? You know, they kept talking about him, and I was like, every time he came up in the conversation, I was like, I've got no fucking clue who Diluc is. And then you got the bad guys like Thanatos and yeah, the other ones. They were really memorable. Some bloke on a bike, I think his name's Gary. I don't know. But it was kind of cool. I mean, basically, at the end of the day, your dad had sex with a tree, you know? That is the moral of this story. And it's similar in Final Fantasy Adventure as well. The mum, the girl character in Final Fantasy Adventure, her mum was a tree. So I think, hopefully Frost in Trials of Mana, I'm hoping that someone had sex with a tree in that. Otherwise, it's not technically a Mana game, okay? It cannot be considered canon unless someone has had sex with a tree. But yeah, anyway, guys, overall, love the game. I'm going to give you my scores in a little bit, okay?
All right, well, it was good to hear from our old friend, question mark.
I miss him.
Do you really?
I do. I love Bill. As much crap as I give him and as much crap he gives me, we have a bond.
Yeah. Well, I've been doing some episodes with him lately too, and it's been fun. So
yeah,
we just like to harass each other.
And exactly. That's how this whole RPG, you know, after years, golden years thing is. We just rip on each other.
Yeah. But he did give us another recording with his ratings. So we will be including his ratings today. And we are going to go ahead and move on to that. Our ratings categories today are story, combat, non-combat, visuals, audio, overall feel, bonus category, which does not count towards the final score, final boss. We got all our categories today. And we're going to let Rich go first.
All right. So story. So the story on it really wasn't grand or epic or anything or very memorable, to me at least. It's basically get the sword, collect the orbs, fight the Empire, kill the boss switch, save the world there. So I'm going to give it a 4.
Okay. Well, I we're going to rate them in this order, Rich, Frost, me, Bill, because I think Frost and Bill like the game more, and Rich and I like it less. So we're taking with the what is it, the bitter with the sweet or something like that.
Yeah.
So what do you think, Frost, story?
Okay, so obviously I played this game enough that I enjoy the story. I'd say I enjoy the story enough. I mean, if I was going to rate like Final Fantasy 1, I would still give it a good story score, even though there's not much story there. Mainly, it doesn't get in its own way. There's a little bit with the whole Jack thing that gets a little weird where it feels like you're going back and forth a couple times. But overall, I think I'm going to give it a 7.
Okay. I think Rich's score is a little harsh, personally. I don't think it's a great story, but again, the time it came out, it's not like there were other games doing much grander things. But I'm not going to be super nice either. I think I'll give it a 6 because they did have some twists in there. It wasn't like it was more than like FF1 and maybe even 3. So
the biggest twist was the tree thing.
I guess that's true, but that was
then I need to make my score an 8. I forgot about that.
And this time Bill gave us all his scores in a single recording, so we'll go through all of his at the end here.
Okay.
All right. What about the combat, Rich?
So I didn't have any complaints really about the combat. I know there was a few things here and there where like, okay, this hitting these things is a little rough. Like, what the hell? I'm having a little trouble. The hitbox isn't registering or the magic. I didn't have that many problems. Once you figured it out, just like, you know, Frost said that once you learn the animations and learn what you need to do, it's not too bad. So I'm going to give it a 7.
Okay. Frost.
I'm going to go 8. And that might be just because I've played it so much that it was super smooth for me. So, you know, maybe if I went back at the first time I played it, I had trouble. But I didn't have really any problems with the combat. So.
Okay. I think this is where I'm going to be the meanest. I have so much trouble because I do like the combat, but there's just a couple of things that just really get on my nerves, from the magic leveling system to the learning the animations and the hitboxes. It really felt, even when I wasn't having trouble, that it was a crapshoot.
Just let the hate flow.
This is your experience, Scott. Yeah. What was your experience?
I think I'm going to give it a 5. And especially because of those early game bosses, like, it's frustrating. I can see that this combat system is fun and there's some good in it, but there's just a couple things that I despise about it. So.
It's really harsh there, Scott. It's really harsh.
Well, here we are. Non-combat.
I didn't have any really issue with combat. I'm going to dock it a point, though, for the basically getting stuck in places where the animations get you backed up into a wall and you couldn't get out of that. I mean, I'll knock it a point there. But overall, it wasn't too bad. I thought I had no complaints. I thought it was good. Kept it moving smoothly. I'll give it an 8.
Okay. Frost?
Yeah, I was actually between a 7 and an 8. I was surprised Rich went that high.
I'm not terrible. I'm not mean all the time with these games. I mean, even if I still hate it, I'll be fair.
So I like that they add the weapons for getting around. I like the flammy. I like the cannon travel is interesting. It's hard to talk about. There's not a ton of non-combat, right? I mean, it's walking around, but the issue with rating the non-combat is how good the visuals and the sound is while you're doing nothing, skews that score. So I would say, like, while I'm doing, like, I'm just sitting around walking around, I'd say I'm probably gonna give it, let's see, you also have to count what the fact that you buy armors and stuff, and that's considered non-combat, I guess. The shop systems I'm gonna go ahead. My initial thing I wrote down was 8. I'm gonna stay with 8.
Okie dokie. I'm gonna give it a 7, purely because, like you guys are saying, there's not really a lot wrong with it, but I'm counting the menus as the non-combat. And
I docked mine. That's where the 2 points came from. One was that issue, and then I docked a point for the menu system. So I didn't say that, but yeah, that makes sense.
I felt bad going down any more than a 7 for that, even though I kind of want to. So
let the hate flow. Like I said, just let it flow.
It didn't break the game. It just was different.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Visuals.
All right. So the visuals on this one were, I liked it. I mean, I like that 2D art sprites. I like how all that lays out. Like you said, the Chrono Trigger aspect to it. You've got your Final Fantasy 4, 5, and 6, Octopath Traveler. Like, I find all those visually appealing, that type of art style. So I'm going to give it an 8. I enjoyed it.
Okay. Frost?
Yeah, I love the visuals in this game. The Forest of the Seasons, the Ice Forest, two great places. There's a lot of, you know, different environments that you go to. You know, because you have the sort of the steampunk, you know, also the Mana Fortress type stuff in the old cities. I know it's 1993 and it's a couple years before FF6 and Chrono Trigger. So I know it was early on that, but it's very similar. I'm going to go not quite a 10. I'm going to give it a 9 for basically getting a ton out of us, out of the SNES. And it looks really great.
Yeah. I am going to be even nicer than that. For me, I think it is a 10. I'm a sucker for pixel art. I think the game looks great. I think that's probably the best thing about the game is how it looks. You do have a point that maybe it can't stand up to something like FF6, but again, they were really coming into their own with the pixel art and probably, you know, built on this with that and Chrono Trigger. And just looking at this game, it does evoke a lot of the feelings of Chrono Trigger just with the visual design. So I thought it was really good. Audio,
the music was good. I like that 8-bit sounds. I like the feel of it. Towns had different music. The overall turn from, you know, happy tone to the dark tone once the Mana Fortress popped up, I thought that was really great. I'm going to give it a 9. I really enjoyed it.
All righty.
It didn't annoy me.
So there's, I think there's 44 or 45 tracks in this game. And Scott asked me to send him 9. And I was like, only 9? I love this soundtrack. I don't know if you, how you describe it. It's almost like a, what's the word? Like prog rock for half of it. It's
I can see
I
that.
Feel like it could be an opera or like a you know what I'm talking about, like a prog rock opera they could turn it into. But yeah, I love the music. I'm gonna give this a, it's not, so I'm not the type of grader who's like a 10 has to be perfect. I'd say it's a 10. It's in my top handful of SNES soundtracks.
Okay. I do think it's a good soundtrack. I didn't love it though. Like if I think back, there's only a few tracks I could probably recall offhand, which I'm pretty into video game music. So usually I can remember a lot more if a game has a really good soundtrack. Not saying this doesn't, it just maybe didn't hit a lot for me. Audio, as far as like the sound effects, I think the sound effects were generally pretty good. And the spells flying all over the place and the enemies getting hit. I don't really have a lot of problems with it. I'm going to give it an 8. Okay, overall feel.
I'm just going to jump right into it. We talked about that overall entire review. I didn't hate it. I didn't like overly gush love it and everything, but it's a good RPG. I'm glad I played it. I'm glad it's done. I'm going to give it a 7.
Okie dokie.
Obviously, I nominated this. It's one of my favorite games of all time. The only thing, every time I play it, I always kind of in the back of my mind are like, do I really have to level the magic? So just for that one little thing that bothers me every single time I play it, I'm going to give it a 9.
Yeah. And we didn't even mention how you get like the last half of your elements at the last very end. Like third or fourth of the game.
It's kind of a crunch.
Yeah. I'm going to give it a 7, like Rich. I think it's a good game that has some very, for me anyway, unfortunate, serious problems. And if it wasn't for those couple of things, then I would probably give it a couple points higher at least. It's very sad to me that the remake didn't go out of its way to sort of fix those major issues for me, but what are you going to do? Okay, so now we have our bonus category, Final Boss, which I guess would be the, do we want to count it as the Lich and the Mana Beast or just the Mana Beast? What do you think, Rich?
I would say we'd probably do the Mana Beast. That's what I was thinking.
Let's do it then. What do you think?
So, not very memorable is what it is. The way to do it was kind of interesting. How to power up the sword, time it right, hit the guy, you know, rinse, wash, and repeat, all that fun stuff. I'm going to give it a 6.
Okay.
So I'm going to go higher just because I really like the sprite that they used for the Mana Beast and the cool. Sorry.
I said it did look cool.
Yeah. And the if you take everything into account with the final boss, so the environment you're in, the music that's playing, the fact that you finally unlock Dryad and you're like, oh, finally, what does this do? And you get you regain the mana sword and it's story related. I'm going to give it besides that, it's not much as far as combat. Rich is right. It's you wait till your turn, make sure your sword's charged up and whack it. But as an overall experience, I'd say it's an 8.
Okay. For me, I would say that it is, it's kind of more of a story battle, right? Like you guys were saying, the real final boss is the Lich right before it, which since I didn't have Lumina, I appreciated that was challenging, but even as piss poor shape as I came out of that battle, I was still able to handle the Mono Beast, thankfully. Just barely though. And it's very cool that I think it's using some mode 7 shit to fly around in the background or something. And it does look cool. Like you said, I'll give it an 8 too. Okay. And, while I total up everything, we are going to see what Bill had to say. Cause, again, he gave us all in one recording, so hopefully I'll have to listen closely and not miss any of his numbers.
Hi, everybody. It's me again. I'm back, and here are my scores for The Secret of Mana. So, story. I liked the story. I thought it was really nicely done. It was very simple, straightforward. I'm going to give it a 7 out of 10. Because it wasn't anything revelationary. It wasn't, you know, they portrayed it well enough, but it wasn't anything fantastic as far as I'm concerned. Combat. I'm going to give combat a 6 because the wonky hitboxes were slightly annoying. The bosses as well, especially the Demon Gate walls were just terrible, those wonky hitboxes. But it was still kind of fun, you know. The game definitely was okay there. Non-combat is a bit of a difficult one because I loved all the exploration and everything like that, but I hated the ring menu system. I thought it was a terrible piece of trash. So I'm going to have to go halfway down the middle and unfortunately give it a 5. So I do apologise. But visuals, I'm going to give it a 10. For an early SNES game and considering the development hell they had to go through to get this out, it's definitely a 10 out of 10 for me as far as I'm concerned. Audio, I'm going to give a 9 out of 10 because it's really, really good. I love it. I've been listening to the OST in my spare time just because I've enjoyed it so much. But unfortunately, I'm going to have to knock it off 1 point for the dwarf theme because the dwarf theme is terrible. Sorry, apologies for my French. Overall feel for the game is definitely a 9 out of 10. This game leaves you with a lovely, lovely taste in your mouth is all I'm going to say. And as for the final boss, they really... Yeah, oh no, it's a bonus category, but they really mixed it up for the final boss because none of the other bosses were quite like it. And it was interesting. They threw brand new mechanics at you, which you had to kind of work out on the fly. I really, really did like that. So I'm going to give the final boss a 8 out of 10, I believe. Yeah, 8 out of 10 sounds good. And that gives me a total of 46 out of 60, which gives me a overall score of 76.66. So I'm going to hand you back over to Scott and Rich where he can work out the rest of that janky mess. Bye, guys. Love you all. Remember, the secret is the dad fucked a tree.
Jesus.
He really got that wood.
He loves that.
All right. I have, let me just double check my math one more time. I don't want to get this wrong, and math is hard.
I do, while you're checking that, I do like to say that, you know, looking at the overall scores and everything, we're all pretty even on these things. Even though, depending on the categories, the whole scores themselves, as Scott figures it out, it's pretty on par.
Yeah, it seems that way. Do you want to read off your scores, Rich?
Sure. I can do, so what I gave mine was story a 4, combat a 7, non-combat an 8, visuals an 8, audio a 9, and overall feel a 7. Followed by the bonus category, the final boss, a 6, which gave mine a subtotal of 43 out of 60, 72% for me.
You got it in front of you to read yours, Frost?
Yeah. So I gave the story a 7, combat an 8, also the non-combat an 8, visuals a 9, the audio a 10, overall feel of 9. Final boss I gave an 8 for a percentage of about 85%.
I gave story a 6, combat a 5, non-combat a 7, visuals a 10, audio an 8, overall feel a 7, final boss an 8, for a subtotal of 43 out of 60, or 72%. And then Bill gave story a 7, combat a 6, non-combat a 5, visuals a 10, audio a 9, overall feel a 9, and final boss an 8, for a subtotal of 46 out of 60, or 77%. So I would like to note here that Rich and I, even though we rated some of the categories differently, ended up with the same score. And funnily enough, Bill's score ended up being the overall rating. So the overall rating for Secret of Mana was 77%. Which, honestly, I feel like is pretty fair, honestly. Like, if I was rating it myself, I don't know that I would go that high. But I think a 77 is a good score and represents this game well. That's just my opinion. You guys got opinions?
I think given the people who played it, I think that's accurate. Right? There's some old school and some new school.
Right. I'm glad we had sort of a mix of opinions, too. So it was good to have you on for this review. So in post, I will go ahead and say where this falls on the chart. I don't have it in front of me right now. But yeah. So that was a fun review. And hey, guys, it's Editor Scott coming to you from the future. I just wanted to tell you where Secret of Mana fell on our final ratings list. So as far as our ratings go, Secret of Mana ended up at the number 31 spot as far as out of all the games we've reviewed. Tied with Animal Crossing New Horizons. And that's it. It's right above Resident Evil 3, the 2020 remake, and right below Star Ocean First Departure and Dragon Warrior. And then if you want to count just the RPGs, it's our number 20 RPG. And that's between, again, Dragon Warrior, Star Ocean First Departure, and Rise of the Tomb Raider. As far as how much of an RPG it is, referring to our RPG scale, it scored a 230. And that puts it as firmly as an RPG, and that is between the Final Fantasy VII Remake. So it's more of an RPG than the Final Fantasy VII Remake at 205, but not as much of an RPG as Final Fantasy I at 270. So yeah, there you go. Now we're going to go into some of our listener feedback on the game, and Rich is going to kick us off.
Awesome. So the listener feedback we have is a longtime listener is Brandon, a good friend of the show. Basically, I'm not sure why this is considered such a great classic. But these are my pros and cons. So pros, the art style, music, and vibrant locales. Cons, listed a little bit longer on the con side here. Uninteresting story. Difficult to read text, steep difficulty curve, hard to navigate without a guide, frustrating combat, unintuitive magic system, and frustrating menus.
I think Brandon had a similar feeling to me, to where he is glad that he had it under his belt, because it is considered such a classic, but ended up not being, you know, maybe too positive on it. ROB said, Secret of Mana was an interesting game. I can see they were trying to be different than the other RPGs out at the time, and it's very hit and miss. Positives would be the music was very beautiful. Graphics looked good for the time. Definitely brought the nostalgic feel for the SNES days. The story was typical RPG fanfare. Nothing special really stands out other than that, from what I've heard in the past. If it's a modern game, then someone had sex with a tree at some point. As for the bad hit detection, it was god-awful. I never charged attacks. It was mash attack and hope one of the swings hit. Sounds very familiar. The menu system was annoying at best, and I'm sorry, 4 of each item? 6 question marks? We didn't even talk about that, but it does limit your items. But I feel like that the game would have been unbalanced if they hadn't done that, especially later on. But anyway, at least make it where each person could hold 4 of something, or something like that. Maybe if I played this when I was younger, it would have had a stronger hold on me, but I was forced into a different path through other JRPGs and set into I'm set into what I like from my 16-bit games. Overall, I'm glad I played it at least, and I won't roll out trying other Mana games just in a rush to. Okay, not in a rush to, I'm assuming. Yeah, that's what you said.
Yep.
And then finally, Ben C. says, This still remains my favorite RPG. I get around to playing every few years, and it was great to experience playing it with the RPG club. It was great to provide tips and tricks to the rest of the club during the few months we played. I agree with them. That's something we haven't really talked about, but this doing this with the RPG club was probably the only way I would have made it through it. So.
Yup.
Goes on to say, I decided to make my playthrough a bit more interesting by not using any magic out of necessity other than cure. I love the dynamic combat system that allows you to rotate through all your characters to deliver attacks at just the right moment. Pro tip, have your AI character set to change to the maximum number, charge to the maximum number. Then you can switch to them when they are in position to deliver an attack, even if they have not fully charged. That's interesting. I never really found myself, this is Scott talking now, really switching between characters a whole lot, just because I felt like it was so easy to switch too much, like, because it's so easy. You just press select. I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I did too. I stayed one person.
I think that first spiky fight is designed to teach you to do that, though.
Yeah. Maybe that's why it was so hard for me. It goes on to say, the multiple environments, music, and combat mechanics are all highlights. The story is not the greatest, but there's not too much time dedicated to it, so you really don't have to be paying attention. The game will always be a 10 out of 10. And I believe Ben C. is one of the hosts of Hyrule Podcasters, so shout out to that show. I recommend it. Yeah, but that's all the feedback we got. Sounds like we all had a kind of a mixture of opinions from, you know, 10 out of 10 to, you know, gutter fire. Dumpster fire. So it's nice to see such a divisive game, I guess. But yeah, you guys ready to close out this club and this review?
Yep.
Sweet. All right, let's get on to it then. So that's it, everyone. Another RPG club in the books. And we got another one that we'll be starting next week. So that's going to be exciting.
So excited to announce that one.
Yes. As of this recording, we haven't announced it yet. But
yes,
I'll put it in post here in just a second. So next week, I'm not sure exactly what we'll be doing. It's either going to be a news episode with Rich and I, plus the RPG club, or it'll be the Final Fantasy Adventure review. About how long was that episode, you know, offhand, Frost?
We pushed 2 hours, but I think there was a lot of editing that had to be done.
Okay. So going into our plugs here, we would appreciate it if you would go on to Apple Podcasts or whatever your podcatching platform may be, if it has a review system, and giving us a 5-star review. It really helps the visibility of the show, and it would mean a lot to us.
Yes. Another way you can help support the show is going to Patreon. You can definitely donate to us to help the show improve. Some of the bonus features of that, you get early episode access, ad-free episodes, the aftercast, extra reviews by Scott and Corey, the famous RPG Club, and many more. You can find that at patreon.com/RPG After Years.
Yes, and if you want to join the show live, you can do that by heading over to Twitch. And usually we are live Sundays at 9 a.m. Eastern time, but keep your eyes on our Twitter and Discord or whatever for updates on that. That's at twitch.tv/RPGAfterYears.
If you want to get some merchandise from us, guys, we do have merch. Scott likes to show those off during his streams. You can find that at redbubble.com/people/RPGAfterYears/explore as I stutter through that.
If you want to drop us an email, you can do that by emailing us rpgafteryears@gmail.com. Our inbox is always open.
Now, another great way to talk to us is through the Discord. We have a lot of great people in that community, a lot of helpful people with RPG knowledge, such as Frost here is from the Discord. You can find that in the show notes or our pinned tweet on Twitter.
And speaking of Frost, we want to thank you one more time, Frost, for coming on to the review. I think you've genuinely made these reviews a better episode. So
thanks. Well, I'm always welcome. Happy to come on and gush about a 30-year-old game.
Absolutely. And we'd be glad to have you on again. Just got to find the right rhyme or reason, I guess.
Yes.
And then finally, if you guys want to get onto our Twitters, you can reach out to the show at RPG Years. If you want to contact me personally, I'm also on Twitter at the Scott Spot.
And you can contact me if you like at HailBlue1569.
Absolutely. I don't know why anybody would want to do that, but
nope.
I'm kidding.
Very quiet.
But that's going to be it for episode 82 and this RPG Club and the Secret of Mana review. And next week, we'll do who knows what, but I know there'll be some RPG Club stuff somewhere soon. Got a lot to look forward to. But until then, I'm Scott.
I'm Rich.
I'm Frost.
We will catch you guys later.
Thank you.
The beast has been slain. The world has been saved. Our heroes are basking in the after years. They rest in the tavern for all to hear their tale of victory and conquered fears. Revel in the peace that reigns through the land. All will know it was by our heroes' hands. Here in the after years. Here in the RPG after years. Here in the RPG after years.